I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing our Sunday stream an hour later than usual because we decided not to step on the toes of the Patriotic Alternative show, which should be wrapping up right around now. And we have two special guests tonight. We have F. Roger Devlin, who's widely known. He's one of our most popular authors. Roger, welcome to the show.
Hi. Glad to be here, Greg.
And the other guest is Martin Lichtmetz. Martin is the author of, well, many, many works, but we're going to principally talk about his work, Ethnopluralism, which Roger Devlin recently reviewed at Countercurrents, and I'm going to share a link to that in the chat on DLive here. Folks, if you have questions or comments and you would like to also attach a little tip to those, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents and hit the green button and leave an offline chat, or which allows you to use a credit card to send money to Countercurrents. And because we have been deplatformed from the global credit card industry, Entropy is the only platform that will actually allow us to take credit card donations now. They're a very good group of people. They've stood by us, and we stand by them, and we urge you to use their services. So I want to talk about ethnopluralism, and Martin has written a rather impressive book on it. It's out only in German, but we can always hope that there'll be an English translation in the future. And if folks want to read it, you can tune in to Countercurrents. You can find it at Countercurrents. And the review that Roger Devlin wrote is now linked on the front, linked in the chat here, and it's up on the front page at Countercurrents right now. So I guess how to begin. Martin, can you tell us basically how this book came about? How did you come to write it?
Yes, well, it is indeed quite a long story, and I hope I'll be able to explain most of it or parts of it in English. I have been working on this book for about 2 years or so, and it all started with this thing that the term ethnopluralism is usually ascribed to new right as a new described as a new right ideology on certain Antifa and left-wing sites and so on. And it had several definitions going on to that. And I remember when I entered the new right in Germany, must have been so about 2005 or so, this term didn't play a role at all. Well, it was sort of an antique term from the 1970s. It was invented by a guy called Henning Eichberg. He was a leading thinker of the German right back then, which differed in many ways from today's German new right, which is also a sort of, not a very homogeneous group. It's rather a broad term. But anyway, there was this term, ethnopluralism, invented in 1973 by this guy, Henning Eichberg. And there were all kinds of definitions going on what this actually means, right? And I was puzzled because I couldn't identify with any of those definitions. And I also didn't see that it played a big part in new right circles back then. This changed in the early 2000s when the identitarian movement came about and there were new, fresh faces and thinkers like Martin Sellner, and he adopted this term and he brought it to a new life. And so this is how the term became important again. And now my idea was I had to look up where does it come from, what does it mean, what does it not mean. And when I started doing it, I realized that first you have a very simple notion of what it is about. And then you go deeper and deeper and the story becomes more and more complicated. So if you have noticed on the cover of the book, there is a net, there's like a fisher net. No? And I was a bit surprised. I asked my publisher, what does this cover mean? And he thought, well, it's like in disentangling notions, concepts. You know, the looking beyond the catchwords, and often a word can have many different meanings. For example, when you go on to talk about racism, which inevitably comes up when you discuss ethnopluralism, you have to ask, what does it actually mean? What does the person who uses this word mean? And so this was like, I was trying to find a clear red thread of the thoughts behind this concept and the different meanings. And this is how it started. And the beginning is very simple. I have started the book with something a woman said on Austrian TV in the 1990s. You know, they were interviewing people who were voting for the Freedom Party, which is the right-wing populist party. And she said something like, I appreciate different cultures, but I don't want to have them close to me. Right. And of course, I found this in a book criticizing the notion of ethnopluralism. Of course, the guy who wrote this article where he quoted this woman thought, "Ooh, this is very, you know, dumb and simple. And you see, it's all very primitive. What she says is very primitive. This was a simple woman." Right. And also the next thing I'm coming up is a joke from the French comic book Asterix. I'm sure you know it. It's, you know, the little Gaul village, and the Romans are sieging it, and they are resisting. And this is also, in fact, a very ethnopluralistic comic, but I won't go into that. So in this comic book, there's a character. He's this old guy. And in one story, he says, I'm not bothered by strangers as long as they stay where they are. So, and of course, this was satirizing, you know, petty chauvinism, petty provincialism and all that. But if you look closer, there may be something deeper into it, which is, you know, not stupid at all, which is, in fact, very human, which is in... And this is the popular form of ethnopluralism, right? But I just start from there, and then the story goes bigger and bigger. So I know I could go on now forever, but this would be my introduction, how I got started here. You know, I was starting to disentangle the notions, the concepts, and see what is there about. And my thesis would be that there's no such thing. There was never a clear program of ethnopluralism among the new right or the German new rights, but there were also different versions of it. And the versions of ethnopluralism, they date back far, far back, even before it was called ethnopluralism, right? So, and to me, the great grandfather of this whole way of thinking is Johann Gottfried Herder. I saw you had on Countercurrents a translation of that chapter. So this is ethnopluralism in the pure form, and there are many versions that come from there. So, what I was saying is there's not a program. There was never a clear single concept. There were different ways of thinking about nationhood, about what it is like to be a people, or all the questions of race and culture have part in this. And from here, it becomes, of course, very complicated. So, yes, that would be my introduction, how this book came about.
Right. The person, of course, who translated the Herder section is here on the stream with us, Roger Devlin. Roger, what are your thoughts about Herder as a progenitor of this idea of ethnopluralism?
He's a rather eclectic thinker. It's hard to get an unequivocal message out of him. He wasn't a systematic thinker. He had many interesting ideas, but people have taken Herder's ideas and gone in many different directions. I even found just the quotations that Martin used in his book to be I couldn't get a really clear a doctrine out of them, and I don't think anybody else has. But he was writing at a time, of course, when he was writing as a sort of a polemic against Enlightenment thought, with its idea of man as such. And so nations were, you know, his angle. Martin says in the book that there's a certain kinship between between Herder and even the great reactionary De Maistre, who's famous for having written that there's no such thing as a man. There are only Frenchmen and Englishmen and Persians. That certainly is right. Herder is interested in the question of differential psychology. I think Martin says at one point, differential psychology from a national point of view. There are actually people who work on this even now. There's like a book that was a bestseller in Sweden some years ago that tried to locate like the Swedish psychological profile in comparison to other nations of the world. And that's something that drives from Herder.
Yeah, the idea of a spirit of a people is very much a right. Herder concept. And
the Volksgeist.
Volksgeist.
As Martin says, the term never actually occurs in his writings.
Yeah, but it certainly, if not the term, the idea is there. And it had a huge influence on the development of thought in the 19th century. Herder is an interesting figure. He's a student of Kant.
Yes.
And an important figure. You know, Kant was very much a figure of the Enlightenment and envisioned global government and things like that. And Herder is a figure of the counter-Enlightenment.
Yes.
Yeah. And in that sense, he is aligned with people like De Maistre and so forth, who are basically trying to deny, if not that there's a meaningful concept of man, that it's politically meaningful, that there are other things that differentiate us besides the fact that we are rational animals that might make it impossible for us to all live together in the same polity. And for Herder, primarily, that's language, and more broadly, just evolved customs and practices that differentiate peoples that sometimes are very similar, you know, genetically, biologically, but
yes,
they live in different worlds because they speak different languages.
Yes. Yeah.
I really think that, you know, I've thought this for some time. I like Herder a lot, mm-hmm. and I've been meaning to write something about him because I think he's, you know, as the kids say, our guy. He's, you know, as a thinker, he gives us all the foundational ideas that we need for ethno-nationalism, ethno-pluralism. And so I was very, very happy when you offered to translate that. I've been wanting to make Herder one of the guys that we have a routine commemoration for. And we've had a few things about him on the website over the years. Alex Graham wrote something about his work on folk music and things like that. And I just liked there to be more, but I just didn't have time to write about it. And so you came along opportunely with Martin's writing and translated it. So that was very good. Martin, do you want to say more about Herder?
Yes, we can talk a bit more about Herder. First of all, congratulations to Roger for the translations. It's very difficult to do. Also, not so easy to read in German original. Yes, as you said, Greg, Herder, he's not a systematic thinker. He's counted among the romantics. And what I was found most striking is the sense of wonder in his writings. In one of his books, he starts like from space, zooms down on the earth, and then he sees all these different continents and vegetations, and he sees the people with the different customs and languages, and he gets very excited about this. This is to him a sort of proof how divine creation is, and then he goes on to what he was most interested in, to find the spirit of the people, and he would find it in their just song, music, and art primarily. But what Herder would be interested in were more the small, the common people, those he felt that were neglected by the Enlightenment. And De Maistre is very different because he thinks from above, from the throne and the altar and order. And Herder is more like the populist from above. He thinks in terms of the folk. And this is what what moves him and what strikes him. And here's something important about the whole idea of ethno-pluralism. Why is pluralism a good thing? Why should you have these differences? Why should not everything be the same? And Herder, he really rejoices in this difference. And he was writing at a time when, the Industrial Revolution started, the modern age, basically. And during the course of the 19th and 20th century, there was this fear of homogenization of societies by industrialization, by what we call globalization. If you develop machines like steamships and trains and later airplanes, the world becomes sort of smaller. People become more connected. It starts a globalization and a mixture. And there's always this fear in anti-modern critiques that everything will be mashed up, everything will be the same. And this fear already starts with Herder, I think. And Herder, he emphasizes the beauty of difference. But if you try to advocate why is difference, why is pluralism good, you will find many different answers. So I don't think there can be just one answer that is like a mathematical conclusion, but there will be different kind of answers. So Herder's answers would be yes, because this is creation, this is divine, this is the music of the creator, so to speak. And he has the term of humanity. He talks about humanity a lot. This word has a great meaning for him, but in a different way than universalists, Enlightenment universalists, who would propose this unity of humanity. Herder also sees a sort of unity in humanity, but this unity exists like a big orchestra of many different colors. It's like a huge painting, a huge romantic painting of different colors. And other thinkers in the course of the next century, they would see this a bit more darker, like they would see more the conflict, the contradictions, they would see more the struggle between races for survival. But Herder, he has the vision that this could work in harmony, that there is no need to suppress one people of another. Everybody could live in his garden, and he thinks of the national garden where people live in as something more, folksy, more romantic. It's full of plants. It's not an ordered thing. So he always keep in mind he's like not thinking from above like the Mestre, but he's thinking from below. And of course, this notion of Herder could be seen as maybe naive, or maybe he has certainly an optimistic anthropology, so to speak. His idea of human beings is more like Rousseauian in a way. Other than later in the book, I talk about Spengler and his visions of pluralism. And in Spengler, you have a much darker image of this pluralism on the world. I mean, Spengler is also interested in these different kinds of cultures and how they mingle and how they fight against each other and how they rise and fall, the story. But in Spengler, he's not interested in the little people, for example, like Herder. He's only interested in the broad cultures and the broad dominating pictures. And he doesn't care so much about plurality in itself, I think. I think in Spengler, it's more what kind of triumphant spirit can rise out of this. He's interested in the big titanic things, and if little people perish, it's of no use to him. So you see, I count Spengler in this family of Herder, but he's also a very different kind of animal. So you see, this kind of thought can go into very different directions. And we could say, Herder in many ways would be our guy, in a way that he celebrates diversity. Now, I have said something which is usually used by the multiculturalists. This would be another interesting line of thought. We could discuss how multiculturalism may be also coming out of Herder. Like this criticism is being made very often by centrists, that they say multiculturalists and identitarians, they're just two sides of the same coin. And this is why we reject them all together. And this is also something I was diving into here in my book. And I would say, yes, it's true. Herder can also be interpreted as the father of multiculturalism or certain kinds of multiculturalism, because there are also variations and different concepts here.
The big issue between ethno-pluralists and left-wing multiculturalists is the question of separation. We believe in maintaining differences, and to maintain differences, we think that different cultures need to have their own spaces and their own autonomy, whereas multiculturalism is constantly railing against the idea of a particular space that is marked by a single culture. They want every space to be multicultural. Whereas my view as an ethno-pluralist is that I want the planet to be multicultural.
Yes.
And to keep the planet multicultural, we have to make sure that the different cultures have their own spaces, because if they don't have their own spaces, then that's precisely how everything gets blended together and homogenized.
Well, yes, Herder would agree with you. So I would certainly say Herder is more like our guy. Then he's the guy with the multiculturalists. But I guess things can be a bit complicated if you consider what space are we talking about. And I have in my book devoted a few chapters to the model that originated in Canada. I drew on the books of Ricardo Duchesne, right? He wrote a lot about it. He wrote a very interesting book about the decay of Canada. And you can see a sort of multiculturalism in Canada, which is different than in the United States. In the United States, the model would be more like, let's create this melting pot, which of course did not work, right? But in Canada, it's a bit different. It started in the 1960s. When there was this problem of how to reconcile the interests of the French population and the British, the Anglo population. And there was also a third group, which were the indigenous people. And there was a real tension between the French and the Anglo group in Canada at that time. And eventually the French group was granted more autonomy. And there was also autonomy granted to the indigenous groups, the Indians. So you have this thing that you have one state, but within the state, you have spaces that are sort of segregated. I mean, I don't mean this in a negative way, or not in a like the American race segregation way, but they are segregated, sort to speak. And what happened next is that there was a project in Canada started by the father of Justin Trudeau, or the alleged father. Maybe you have heard the Castro theory. I'm
right.
I believe it's true. Okay, so
very plausible when you look at the pictures. Yeah,
yeah, totally. So there was Pierre Trudeau, and already in the 60s, they had this idea to transform Canada into this new model universal nation. But the concept would not be like a melting pot, but more like you have a bit more like what Horace Cullen called the salad bowl. Like, so the groups, they would not mix, they would have the separate spaces, but they would live within one state. And then they would start have immigration to get more diversity and all that. And it was a bit more strict than in the US. It was harder to get in, but still they created this horrible nation they have today with this terrible man on top. And so they even had a philosopher to justify that, or two philosophers I mentioned. And one is this guy, Charles Taylor, and he's a very important ideologist of multiculturalism. And he refers to Herder a lot, much refers to Herder. And the other guy is Kimlicka, I don't know how to pronounce him, but Robert Duchesne, he covered those two a lot. And you can see that the line of thinking often is quite similar to certain ethno-pluralist thinkers, also of the new right of the 60s and 70s, like in France, Alain de Benoist and all that, and in Germany, Henning Eichberg. But the difference is that you create this sort of society within a single state. And here's where the trouble begins. I guess it could have worked with a balance between the French and the Anglo in Canada, because the culture is not so very different. I mean, language creates a huge barrier, and there were severe tensions between them. But if you overdo it, if you overstretch it, then it sort of collapses. So today we have this Canadian nation and the prime minister who says, we are proud there's no Canadian identity. We have a world, a universal identity, you see. And this is where it runs completely against what the ethno-pluralist idea was about. So I would say the ethno-pluralist idea does not necessarily say that each ethnic group should have their own nation. It's possible to have a country, a nation, where you have several ethnic groups and all have their certain rights to keep their identity. But what multiculturalism is doing is that it's aiming to actively dissolve already existing nations and homogeneity within nations.
Right.
And this is the big difference. This is what the centrists that say there's a horseshoe theory between the left identitarians and the right identitarians, they don't get it, because the right identitarians, they're defending their own, and the others are using the outside difference to dissolve what is their own. This is the right difference, yeah.
I do think it is possible to have multiple linguistic and cultural groups in the same state. I think the Swiss Federation is a good example of that. But they have reached a system where they don't feel like their identities are threatened by participation in the Swiss Federation. And therefore, there's no real pressure to break it up. Whereas if you have a society where you've got multiple groups, and the way that things are set up, it's profoundly threatening to the preservation of their identity, then I think that we should affirm the right of distinct groups to secede and create their own autonomous homelands. And a right is not an obligation. They don't have to secede. You know, the Romansh language speakers of Switzerland don't have to create an ethno-state. But if they felt that their identity was being submerged and that the Swiss Federation was hostile to their continued existence as a distinct group of people, then I would say that, you know, people should stand aside and let them go. The situation with Canada is really interesting. Canada was, it had basically three ethnic groups. It had the French, it had Anglo-Canadians, and people who, then there were various immigrant groups that assimilated into one or the other basic populations, you know, learned the language, adopted their customs, etc. And then there were the Aboriginal people. There was a lot of tension in that society, and they worked out a modus vivendi. And I don't get why that was an argument for increasing the tensions in society. It's like you listen to leftists. I've listened to leftists waxing poetic and mourning the horrible conflicts between the Irish and the English, and then without batting an eye, they think it would be great if they added more Pakistanis to the United Kingdom. And it's like, wait a second here. If there are all these tragic conflicts between people as similar as the Scots and the English, why invite more trouble, right? So I don't get. Was there an argument for, okay, wow, we've got these tensions between these three groups in Canada, so and things are working out so well, why don't we create more problems for ourselves? I don't see how that follows. How did these people make that argument?
Well, I guess there's no short answer to this, but one important thing is here what I would call a passion for universalism. And this is at the center of, if you start thinking about ethnopluralism, it's a critique of universalism. And universalism is something that is very central and very important throughout Western culture and Western history. There's this book by Kevin MacDonald about I forgot the title. He goes on about how Western civilization has developed a certain liberal and universalist mindset, individualism more, which is based on certain genetic and historical developments and so. So universalism is something that has been very important for our history. And universalism is also what has created the present crisis and globalism and all that. And people who are criticizing this from the new rights, they have a sort of problem here, because they have to take a stand against parts of their own tradition, of their own way of thinking. And I think many multiculturalists, of course, some are motivated by different reasons, but I can see it in many of them. I see a sort of universalist passion here that doesn't just satisfy itself by saying, well, we have created this society, it works very well, we want to have all the world to adopt our model, and we want to invite all the world. This is before the guilt aspect comes in. So the criticism of universalism, going back to the 19th century, when the West was very self-confident and colonialism was there. In colonialism, you had this idea of bringing civilization to the savages, of bringing a way of life. It was not just about exploiting or enslaving them. In fact, colonialism in the second phase abolished slavery and fought against slavery in Africa and other countries. So there was a noble idea also behind colonialism, that what is good for us is also good for everybody else. And this idea is still there, but it has fused with the white guilt thing, like we have to give them, the people we have exploited or subjugated or treated racist, we have to give them a sort of compensation. And I have in my book treated a text which Roger also mentioned in his review, by two German leftists, where they envision a Europe which becomes a sort of mini world civilization, where you invite people from all the world, from all continents. They come to our continent. Hey, and we have space, they argue. They say we are demographically shrinking, so we have enough space for them, Lebensraum, so to speak. And they should come here, and they should found their cities. They should found their new Baghdad and their new Delhi and whatever. So it's a really weird visions. And those people who wrote it, they are not nobodies. You know, they're actually very acknowledged thinkers. Prices have been heaped upon them. So they have this idea of creating on European soil a world civilization. And this world civilization should benefit from all the good things that Europeans invented, like the rule of law, like a welfare state, like industrialization, and so on, so on. So there's also a sort of savior complex here. Quite a lot going on here. But the interesting thing is that the very concept of ethnopluralism, the way Heining Eichberg thought it in 1973, was coined in an essay that criticized aid for third world, for third world help for third world. I have the wrong word here, I know, but he criticized the idea that the West should help third world countries to rise to their level.
Yeah, because development.
Yeah, they're sort of development aid. Yes, development aid. Yeah. And in the beginning, and this is a very interesting thing, the concept of ethnopluralism, as Henning Eichberg thought it, was opposite to Eurocentrism. So he argued, it's Eurocentrism to think that all these cultures, they need our ways of life. They need our morals, they need our culture, they need our way we run a state, and so on and so on. He argued that it uproots them, it destroys them, right? And the interesting thing is that from here, you can also make an argument to say yes. So we do not enforce our way of living on them, but at the same time, we do not, for example, want to import them. No, we don't want to have them here in our countries, right? So this is a bridge to create an argument against immigration, which you can frame as not being racist, you see, or not being xenophobic. And right. this is the way the argument was mostly used in a popular way. You know, I quoted this woman in the beginning. She's a simple woman. She votes for the Freedom Party, who says, I appreciate different cultures, but I don't want to have them close here. And this is here where the criticism of the left, of course, starts. They say, oh, this is just thinly disguised racism. They try to paint it in a beautiful picture. They use this anti-colonialist rhetorics, this anti-universal rhetorics. In fact, they just don't want any Africans here, which is, in a certain way true, you know, but it's, of course, a bit primitive framing here. The thing is a bit more complex. So
they're just trying to take a more subtle idea and reduce it to something crude and disgusting.
When I first read the old New Right, European New Right stuff from 1970s, also Nouvelle Droite in France is very, very similar to Henning Eichberg's argument. Mm-hmm. I found this argument very striking. The thing to say, why should we impose our culture, our way of living on them? And it just creates, it just doesn't work. It just creates, it uproots them. It creates these failed states. It creates a lot of tension there. We mean good. You know, the Europeans first, we came there as colonialists. We wanted to bring civilization. This didn't quite work. Then we drew back, but still we want to do something to help them, to uplift them. And all these countries are basically a mess by our standards, maybe because right. they tried to be like us. So I thought this was a very striking argument. And I'll be finished soon. There's something also more deep to it for me that, again, if you take this argument serious, not just as a pretext, so I can say, they stay at their place, we stay at our place. But if you take it seriously, if you say, yes, he's really concerned about the uprooting of other people and other cultures, because he is terrified of this idea of a unified, homogenized world where everything is just the same, then it makes a much deeper sense, you see, than just making your xenophobia look good. And this is Absolutely. Something, yeah, and this is something I think is very important. And in my book, I point out that it's not only right-wing people that had this fear or this notion. For example, there's one writer, poet, filmmaker that I really adore, is Pasolini, the Italian filmmaker. He was a communist, of course, but he was very interested. Many of his thoughts were surprisingly close to New Right thinking. And he, in the 1960s, he was really worried about the homogenization of Italy, of the certain regional dialects and the certain ethnic groups in Italy, if you call them ethnic groups, like Friuli region where he came from. It had a certain dialect, and he was afraid of all this becoming just one bourgeois, technicized, standardized, boring, modern world thing. He was really horrified by it. He saw the way he saw Southern Italy changed. He appreciated the way people in Southern Italy lived. He saw that traditions, cultures, differences were eradicated. And he was talking just about Italy. And he even went so far as to say, there's a genocide going on of Italians, not an actual genocide that they're killed, but a cultural, a mental genocide. In a way, they were all being made the same. Yeah. And he would also look out that he, like many leftists or communists, he had this third world romanticism, like he would idealize the third world. I don't follow that. And I think it's pretty preposterous, but there's also something true about it, that he really was worried to see these people in Africa, they start to wear these these American shoes, and they drink Coca-Cola, and they start to they become Americans, you see, they become Americans. And I mentioned another thing, which is interesting. Maybe you know that song by Rammstein, which is called America.
Right.
And you have Rammstein, the landing on the moon, and from the moon, they're looking on the world. And then you have all these colored people, cultures like Asians and Africans and whatever. And you see them all drinking Coca-Cola and eating fast food and listening to American pop music. And the chorus goes like, we are living in America. America is wunderbar. So I see this song as a sort of ethno-pluralistic song. It's a critique of globalization in a way that these superficial, very superficial parts of American consumer cultures are exported everywhere and everybody's being made the same. Of course, this was made during the Bush era and the war against terror era and the neocon thing. And then comes an interesting part where all of a sudden the Rammstein, they appear as Indians, you know, and the music changes and it's like a war song. And they sing something like, this is not a love song, I don't speak my mother tongue. So they're implying, as Germans, they are colonized as well.
Yeah,
they're colonized by American pop culture. They also have lost the war, like the Indians lost the war. And now they are colonized. So there's a certain implicitly nationalist protest here in this song.
So there is very much a similar message in Leibach's album from the 90s, NATO, where they actually take a song about, I think it was a song called Cherokee Reservation, and they redo it about the Balkans. And it's quite rich and ironic the way that they rework this. But yeah, it's an anti-imperialist song. And I kind of get romanticizing the Third World in the same way that I kind of romanticize peasants and I romanticize folk culture and folk music like Herder did. You don't have to want to live like, you know, Andean Indians and things like that to recognize that their way of life is actually quite nicely, it's unique in its own way. It fits them as a unique people. It fits their unique landscape. It fits their unique resources, the things that they have available to them. They've made something unique and beautiful in their corner of the world. And I like these orders that rise from below, the sort of spontaneous orders of folk cultures that arise from below. And if left to their own devices, they bloom and create, you know, great beauty and, you know, diversity and interest, sometimes great ugliness, things that will shock us too. But still, there's something lovely about that, as opposed to a kind of a top-down homogenizing order that all of these rationalists want to impose upon the world. And there are two kinds of rationalists. There's the ideologues who think there's a right way that, you know, they have for everybody. And then there are just the capitalists, the globalists, the guys who, you know, they want to teach the world to sing so they can sell it Coke, and they want to break down borders so they can sell products more easily. But the net result is basically the same. I love how, you know, the fallout of the Afghan adventure coming to this to an end. All of this framing in terms of humanitarian imperialism is very, very front and center to this discourse today on the Afghan withdrawal. We can't do this. We have obligations to these people. What about the women? That kind of stuff.
It's a new Afghan adventure beginning, though, because we're going to be importing them. We didn't learn from trying to rule them for 20 years that we couldn't make them into Americans. So now we're going to make them into Americans by bringing them in, right?
Yeah.
Same error. Of course, same error. So it's
same
it's,
error. They're going to assimilate
it's
us.
Invite them. It's the invite them formula.
It's chapter two. Taylor. It's It's chapter two of the same story, basically. The Biden administration is doing everything it can now to take in as many Afghans as possible.
And it's also framed as a sort of compensation because we have failed to bring our civilization there. And now these poor people, they have to flee from the evil Taliban. And now we have to take them in as a sort of compensation.
Yeah. And they're poor beggars and we have to feel sorry for them. But also we're assured simultaneously that they'll bring us great riches when they arrive here.
Yeah, well...
at the end of your book, you talk about ethno-pluralism and how it functions in four ways. So you describe ethno-pluralism as an approach to the world that values the different ways of being human. And I think that's fair enough. We've sort of done that. A necessary instrument of self-criticism for Western thought. A third thing you say is that it's a form of anthropological realism, and I'd like you to say a little bit more about that angle. You have a chapter in the book about race and racism. What are your thoughts on that, or how do you treat that? Just give our listeners a sort of brief overview of what you do there.
Yeah, well, the discussion of ethno-pluralism comes always with this problem that in order to maintain your own cultural identity, you have to sort of block out other thoughts or ways of living or other kinds of people. The thing is, you have to be separate. And if a culture values itself, it's very rare that there is this idea we're equal as anyone else, but mostly there's an ethnocentric notion that we are superior than others. You can find it in primitive tribes. They have a concept of what is human, which just applies to them. Yeah, it's of course a very narrow idea. But the point is that many defenders of ethnopluralism would point out that there is some sort of ethnocentrism encoded within human beings. And this is something that is universal. And often they would use the books by Konrad Lorenz, for example. And there was another Austrian researcher, Eibesfeld. And they did research on prejudice, the role of prejudice, for example, to maintain your own culture, your own position here. And anthropological realism means just acknowledging that ethnocentrism is something that cannot be eradicated. Tribalism is something that cannot be eradicated. Not totally, no? You can, of course, enlarge the idea of your tribe. You can adopt different attitudes towards other tribes. But in the end, it's something hardwired. It will always appear. And of course, globalists, they wish to eradicate this. They wish to create a new man which has no prejudices, which has no racism or anything like it. And some hope they can achieve this by race mixing them or just creating some sort of unified race. There are all kinds of weird ideas here.
Well, there goes diversity, right? I mean, that is an acknowledgement that diversity is a problem. When diversity, they start reaching,
the thing is, they use diversity just as a dialectical step. The first step is to dissolve a certain homogenic culture by saying, here's another group, they have the same rights. But in the end, they want these groups not to stay separated. They want, in the long run, they want them to mix because they want to create this unified humanity.
Right.
There's a paradox in their rhetoric or a contradiction in their rhetoric. But if you see this a dialectical step, then you get the picture. And now,
they want to create a world where there's no outgroup, where there's just a unified humanity, but there's no outgroup. But then immediately, they take a breath, and then they define their own outgroup, which consists of us. And Roger, you talk about that in your review. I thought that was very well put. that these people, that one of these people who's envisioning this multi-culti patchwork of Germany colonized by the Third World, immediately rushed out a book about multiculturalism and its enemies.
Yes, yes. Yeah, she wants to build a new Damascus in the middle of Brandenburg. But it turns out she does have enemies. Yeah, she wrote the book called The Open Europe and Its Enemies, I think, is the title of the book. And so yeah,
it's called the Neue Bürgerkrieg, the New Civil War.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it was written, I think, in 2016 or so, at the height of the populist wave. And she's talking about how there would be possibly a civil war within Europe. And curiously, in this book, she does welcome this. She says, well, this will be great because it means that nation states will collapse and then we can create a unified nation, Europe. She really calls it like this. As you know, that many right-wingers have also this idea of a nation, Europe, a nation, you know, like mostly, yes, for example. So, but her vision is, of course, very different because it encompasses importing these ethnic groups from other continents into a sort of universalist European nation. But yes, you're absolutely right. She does know enemies, and she thinks there will be enemies, there will be civil war, there will be differences.
Is she looking forward to this, to fighting?
She's actually, this is the great thing, she's actually looking forward to this.
Yeah. She says, it's a combination of the most absurd utopianism with a real bitter hatred, you know, the politics of friend enemy, you know, toward us. It's exactly what you saw with communism earlier, you know, childish kind of utopianism backed by, you know, a readiness to use more or less unlimited force against enemies.
Yes, we can go back here to Demestre. Like, he was the first one to point out, if you declare humanity is your purpose, is your driving force, is the way you want to go, then everybody who's against you is an enemy of humanity.
And that's
therefore,
right.
Therefore not human that's, anymore.
That's so what the French revolutionaries said.
Yeah.
Yeah, that when they were mastering the Vendée. Yes.
And the communists did just the same. So, and Schmidt, you know, of course, Schmidt pointed this out, that you're creating a total enemy here, because if you think you're the one representing mankind, the other who's against you is outside of mankind. So you can do all kind of inhuman things to him. And this is what happened in communism.
Yes.
Absolutely. The fourth feature of ethno-pluralism is acknowledging that different peoples really are different.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important thing to wrap our heads around, because that I think is at the root of so many of our problems. If people really are different, then that means that they are going to have different ways of life that are comfortable for them, that you can't have a one size fits all way of life. And that's equivalent to, you know, making everybody wears, you know, Mao jackets and stuff like that. You know, it's just like a one size fits all way of dressing and organizing the world. If people really are different, then the differences matter.
Can I say something here?
Yeah.
I used to call this years ago in a different book, the Smarties dogma. And
yes,
I don't know what M&M. Smarties.
We call
M&Ms,
them M&Ms.
Yes. You
yes.
call them M&Ms, right? So you have this aesthetics of diversity, and you always see this group of people, and they're all from different races, and men and women, and they're all in perfect harmony on these pictures, like this rainbow unity. And the advocates of diversity, they pretend that they love this diversity. Look, this one is black, this one is yellow. But the idea doesn't go beyond the M&M sugar coating. They say, oh, this M&M has a yellow coating, this has a blue one, this has a red one. But inside, they're all the same. And now we, you know, we the so-called racists or the ethno-pluralists, and so we say, yes, it's actually us who love diversity, real diversity. Because the moment when you start talking about real diversity, difference in race, difference in ethnicity, difference of genders, difference of cultures, and so on, then they start hating you. They start saying, you're racist, you're discriminating. But in fact, you're being serious about diversity at that point. And here you can see they are not serious really about diversity. They just have this very superficial idea what diversity is about.
Absolutely. And because they have a superficial idea of diversity, they can't really seriously think through the implications of putting lots of diverse people in the same system. Because if diversity is just skin deep, then why can't we all live in the same country, in the same system? Why can't we all, think about time in the same way and think about romance in the same way? Why can't we all mature sexually at the same rate? And on and on and on. They leave all of that out because they think that diversity is all superficial. It's just a matter of colorful costumes and a great variety of restaurants.
Yeah, this is the line of Million Wolves.
Yeah, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I mean, as usual, the left is just twisting concepts, turning them up and down. They're always using words, they just mean the opposite thing. And the same is here with diversity. So what I learned from Herder and from the thinkers of ethnopluralism is that diversity is in fact something good, but diversity is not something harmless also. Yeah? There are good sides to it and there are also bad sides to it, but they come in a package, so to speak. So if you have a certain nation or a certain race or so, you will find good and bad things. You will find twisted things. And often they are intertwined with each other. Often the bad things create good things. I mean, you know about it. If you have ever read the book by Jared Taylor about Japan, have you read this one? It's his first book.
Shadows of the
Rising Sun. Yeah. He wrote it in 1983. And it's a really great book about Japan. And he gives you a good feeling about what is great about this country, but also what is alien and also maybe disgusting, or also maybe, you know, for Europeans, not very attractive, right? And you have in Japanese history, you have incredible cruelties, you know, the way the Japanese treated the Chinese or the Koreans, the horrible things happened. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we have beauty, we have art, we have great writers. You talked about Mishima recently and so. And you see that Herder, he would like to think only about the good sides, right? So he was a romantic. Yeah? But in fact, in every culture, you have these great and these dark sides, and they're creating conflict and so. So the thing is, if you are serious about diversity, I think you will also always, you have to be serious that conflict, in fact, is not necessarily a bad thing, right? And this is also, which ties into the anthropological realism argument. And here I would like to talk a bit about another writer I have covered a lot in the book, is Claude Lévi-Strauss. Roger mentioned that maybe my views are the closest to his. I was surprised to read this, and I thought, yeah, maybe he's right, but not entirely. But the thing is, I have Lévi-Strauss as one of the major thinkers of ethnopluralism, which may be surprising to some because he's not being considered right-wing at all. He's an anthropologist. He's also, some of the right criticize him that he was a cultural relativist, which he was, and ethnopluralism is cultural relativism. This is important. Maybe we talk about it later. But the thing is, I have these two texts by Lévi-Strauss. He wrote them for the UNO, one in the 1950s and one in the 1970s. And one is a sort of correction of the other. And one is called Race and History, and the other is called Race and Culture. I cannot go too much into detail here, but what he's arguing here is that he says it would not be good if all cultures would love each other from one day of another, if they would fall into each other's arms, if they would become tolerant and so on. You know? He says it would create a terrible entropy. It would mean the end of all progress, of all development. you can go back at to Heraclit for this argument. You know, when he says war is the father of all things, or strife is the father of all things. And you find this argument, of course, in a moderated way by Levi-Strauss, but he says it. He says it, it's not good if everybody would be tolerant and nice and if there was world peace, because the world would end, any interesting things would end. And I find this very striking. And one thing I pointed out, which as far as I know, nobody has noticed before, is that Levi-Strauss, he referred several times to Gobineau, who is considered the father of modern racism. You know, he wrote this essay on the inequality of races, and it was a very influential book, not so much in France, but more in Germany, because he was friends with the Wagner clan, and so it influenced on racial thinking in Germany. And most people do not think of Gobineau and Levi-Strauss in the same boat or in the same chapter. But in fact, Levi-Strauss, he spoke quite positively of Gobineau and defended him. And there's one central idea in Gobineau. Gobineau feared that if all the races would mix and turn into some not distinguished mass, all development, all culture, all things that are great would end. You know, everything would just flow into this dull, muddled river where there would nothing be happening anymore. And Levi-Strauss, he just shared the same notion, and so did many people of the New Right in France and so. And I think this is also an important thing, that if you say yes to diversity, you also have to say yes to conflict to a certain extent, because of course there are considerations about it that conflict can create terrible things. It can create genocide, it can create wars. In modern age, we wars are being fought with horrible machines and guns that can exterminate all life on planet. So in a way, the leftists have an argument here as well. So you see there's a tension here, a tension between saying everything should be unified and in peace, and then the argument, but is this really a good thing if everything is in peace forever? Wouldn't this mean that everything would come to a halt? It would mortify, it would cease to develop anymore.
It would be entropy, basically.
Entropy, yes, yeah. Entropy.
Yeah.
Levi-Strauss and Gobineau, both they feared this entropy. And yeah, I can follow this notion, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful, and it's I did not know that about Levi-Strauss, and I thought that was a great discovery in your book. If we recognize that there are going to be different groups, us and them, there is going to always be the possibility of conflict, and then the great question becomes politically how best to manage conflict or mitigate conflict. You don't have to have actual conflicts to maintain the differences between people. You just have to recognize that it's a potential that's always going to be there. And then the question becomes, well, when does this potentiality for conflict become more likely to be actualized? And of course, the answer to that is the closer together they are, the more mixed up together they are, the greater the chance that differences are going to strike sparks and there'll be a conflagration. And so this gets to the politics of ethno-nationalism. The idea that creating bigger and bigger political units is not the path to peace. The Enlightenment, the globalist types think that we will end war when we have a single universal global state. But that's naive. That just means that we are going to have maybe not wars between states, but we're going to have the whole planet will just be a field of endless civil conflict, if you will, as people who are forced to be together fight. Whereas in the past, if they could be separate, they could they could regard one another in cordial contempt, or you know, trade with one another occasionally, exchange goods and services, but not necessarily exchange barbs and bullets.
Yeah, but the question is, was it so bad to exchange the bullets all the time? I mean, I'm posing this question here because if you look at history, you have a lot of war and conflict going on, and it just does not only create devastation, it does also create the advancement of culture. It does create a certain tension. There's nothing that heightens your identity more than if you have a certain enemy, someone who's different. And I see, for example, whole of European or Western history, you have a lot of conflict going on. But this conflict, I think, wasn't necessarily bad, because much of what it has created, it has created strong differences, strong identities. And they don't need to have war all the time. So they can enter a state of peace and a state of exchange, and then the tensions rise up again. And so it goes on and on and on, like circles. And so maybe my worldview is more like Spengler than Levi-Strauss. Yeah, but Levi-Strauss also emphasizes the importance of conflict. And now we have a sort of problem here, because if we look at the root of the misery of European civilization, or one of the roots, I mean, one of the things that was really devastating was certainly the First World War. And well, I'm aware of your argument, Greg, that this was more a war between imperial powers than between nations. But they fought as nations against each other. The English against the Germans, and the Germans against the French and the Russians. There was a deep-seated national enmity here, which resulted in this carnage, but which also had created in the centuries previously and unto that strong differences, which are really interesting, which really keep, so to speak, the thing going. But now we have World War One. We have this war which is fought with machines and which guns, which were previously unknown, and you have this huge slaughter, and it continues until World War Two. I think you can see them as a unity. It's a 30-year war of European carnage, and in the end, basically everybody is exhausted. This is the end of domination of the West over the world. This is the beginning of the end. So I think this paradox can hardly be dissolved, that on one hand, there is a need for strife and war and conflict to create these differences, to keep them alive, to make them thrive, and that this can be very destructive in the modern age. And one problem I have with certain ideas of ethno-pluralism, like this idea that everybody stays peacefully at home, everybody stays separate. To me, this is a kind of a version of the end of history, as Fukuyama framed it. Like, everybody goes home into his own garden, everybody minds his own business, which you cannot do exclusively in a world that will stay globalized. This is no way back. And then what? What would we do then? What happens to our Volksgeist? You know, what if we have a Volksgeist that probably is rather out for conquest and domination? Like, go to the ships, go see another continent, go spread your idea. You see? So I see here something which cannot be satisfyingly solved, if you understand what I mean.
Right. We have some questions here, and one of them addresses this. So I would just want to thank some of the people who've been making donations through DLive. Bruder Klar has donated a Ninjagini. Thank you. Bartleby, one ice cream, 1,001 cuts, one Ninjagini, and says, good show. Thank you. Spartan has donated 2 lemons. Varyag, 1 Ninjagini. Is there an expansionist tendency in Indo-European Volksgeists that conflicts with ethno-pluralism? That's the point that you were just making. And I think that's an interesting question. I think there's a grandiosity to Western man. I think part of that is manifested in, you know, the imperialism, the humanitarian imperialism that we saw with, in the late 19th century, the white man's burden, which of course is continuing on to this day with all of our America's humanitarian meddling around the world. And then there's the sort of Mark II version of this, which is the white guilt version, which is that, you know, we don't bring all the good stuff to the world. We're responsible for all the bad stuff in the world, which is kind of grandiose in and of itself. But yeah, there is this expansionist tendency in white people. The way I put it is that we need to take some of these Faustian drives and enclose them within classical measured limits. That's how we can live together, basically. What are your thoughts on this? Is it part of who we are to undermine ourselves?
Well, not sure if it's part of us to undermine ourselves, but I think universalism is a sort of Faustianism. I think it's no accident that universalism flourished in Europe and in the West, because it sort of rings a bell within our nature, within this Faustian nature, with this idea of going further to the endless, to get it all done. I pointed out in my book that it's mostly Europeans who try to create these philosophies that encompass everything, which like Herder does it in a way, and Hegel does it in a way, and Spengler does it in a way, and Gobineau. They're different versions of it, but it's a typical European thing wanting to do that, to have the whole thing in an idea or in a vision or so. So I think we cannot escape from this. It's so deeply ingrained in our nature. And of course, I think today we have a sort of inverse universalism, which eats us up from the inside. Like this bad sort of universalism. You addressed it with the white guilt, with globalism, with you know, the idea, this crazy idea, we achieve universalism only if we sort of manage to abolish our race and create a real humanity, something like this. But these are all ideas that I think originate in a universalist mindset, and maybe there's some sort of perverted Faustianism here. Not sure. And
well, what about Angela Merkel saying, what did she say?
Wir schaffen das. Yeah.
Yeah, we can do it.
We can do it, yes. No,
we
and
can it's, put it's, men it's, on the moon. We can assimilate a couple million people from the Middle East.
No, you know, when in 2015, 1 million people entered Germany by Merkel's command, when she opened the borders, and there were all these slogans like "Wir schaffen das" and so, it was really strange. Among many Germans, there was a new spirit of Volksgemeinschaft. You know that word? Hard to translate it. You know, all of a sudden they had a Volksgemeinschaft, which was united by helping refugees, by being this open-hearted, helpful, universal, and all the good things. The perverse thing is that what is good in Germans was used for a thing that in the end would undermine them or would harm them. But most Germans who participated in this, they were not aware of this. It was the good side of Wir schaffen das, which was animated, in fact, to help them getting replaced. You know, this is the weird thing, that many of those good sides of the European soul are being inverted, are being used to animate people to undo themselves, right? And in Germany, this is very eminent, very strong. The German spirit is still there as it ever was before. It has just become sort of inverted and perverted. And this is a tragical, sad thing.
Yeah, there's nothing more obscene than being exploited because of the better parts of your nature. basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I want to mention, sorry if I'm jumping here a bit with confusion.
Sure, go ahead.
I wonder if you both have read this little novel by Guillaume Fay. It's called A Day in the Life of Ivan Oblomov. It was an appendix to Archaeofuturism, and it's a sort of science fiction story where he envisions what Europe would look like after it has survived the big cataclysm. So, and he has it set in the future, and there's a huge Eurasian empire restored after there was a great ethnic civil war and the collapse of civilization, and many things had to be changed. I don't want to go too much into detail, but I thought it was quite interesting because he sort of tried to unite the idea of imperialism and ethno-pluralism. Sometimes they're seen as opposites, like nationalism and imperialism, for example. I mean, I find this in your book, Greg, or I find it with the Israeli guy, Yoram Hatzoni, you know, this idea that there's an opposition between nationalism and imperialism, but sometimes there are concepts that try to reconcile this. And in Guillaume Fay's novel, you have this Eurasian empire, which reaches from Portugal to the Bering Strait in Siberia. So there's this huge continental block, which includes Russia. So it's basically a white race block. But within that empire, the ethnic groups are very distinct. And nation states have been dissolved. France, for example, is not a nation state anymore, but there is a Breton part and I miss the words now, but France, you see, as a nation is also composed of different parts or ethnic groups which were very related, and in this novel they have been broken up and they are regions rather than nation states. So Europe is a plurality of regions and of ethnic groups, and they keep their peculiar customs and languages and dialects, and they sometimes have conflicts with each other, and the hero of the story is a high functionary of this empire, and his role is to reconcile the conflicts between these small ethnic groups or sometimes bigger ethnic groups. But the idea is you have both. You have the empire, and within the empire you have this huge pluralism maintained, but the conflict between the groups within the empire never escalates, so they would war against each other. And why? And here comes the point. Because they remember they have a common enemy. And the common enemy used to be Islam. You know, this was a thing with Guillaume Fay. He considered Islam or Islamic peoples within Europe a great menace. And in the past, there had been a war against them, ethnic, a racial war. And this memory, this traumatic memory of the war, unites all these ethnic groups within this empire he envisions, right? So they do have conflicts, but they never get hot because they remember we have a common enemy. And in the story, the big antagonist is the Chinese empire, and to a certain extent also India. Africa has just gone back to where it was 10,000 years ago, and America has completely collapsed. There's a north and a southern state left, and part of America is occupied by Japanese. So the thing is that in this vision you have peace within the Eurasian empire and between the European people or folk groups, but you still have an ongoing conflict with other cultures, which is kept on a certain level to make sure it doesn't escalate. He describes that this empire, they develop great battleships and weapons and guns, and they have a great military, and they just have this military to terrify the Chinese into not attacking them. So the idea is it's a peaceful empire. The empire doesn't expand anymore because they say we have our part of the world now. We don't expand, but don't fuck with us, right? So I'm saying this because I think this is a fascinating little novel because he tried to envision how could it be like, how could it be like to keep peace and diversity at the same time, you see, on a global level. And of course, there's a lot of Schmittian thinking here. The German word in Schmitt is Hegung, Hegung des Krieges. I guess you know that, Greg. I don't know what the English word would be. It's like keeping the conflict mitigated, keeping it into sort of balance and order. The conflict can escalate. You know, this is an idea in Schmitt. There was an idea that you can fight a war and have rules, right? You have a European, you have a European order of how to fight a war, and of course it would not apply between two different empires because they would have to acknowledge the same law. But so yeah, I got lost a bit now. But you see what I'm pointing out here: that the problem that is there with diversity is always that it can lead to conflict. And without conflict, you cannot really have diversity. I think this is an important thing to consider.
Right. Roger, you've read a lot of Phi. What are your thoughts on this particular aspect of him?
I'm trying to remember the story now. I think I may have read it a year ago. I can't remember it that well. But, I may not have much to contribute here. I think Hegung, by the way, is hedging in English. I will say that.
Hedging, okay, yes.
Hedging, yes.
Mm-hmm. A very similar word.
Yeah. Let me just thank a few more people. Bruder Clara has donated 2 Ninja Guineas. That's very kind. Gadius, 4 ice cream and 8 lemons. Bartleby, 1 ice cream. Ride the Tiger, 7 lemons. Gaelic Nord has done 10 lemons. Earlier on in the chat, Roger, somebody asked a question about a condensed version of Leviathan and Its Enemies by...
Oh, yes. Yes, I've announced that several times, and it's not in my hands right now. It has been done, and it's supposed to come out, and the Fitzgerald Griffin Foundation is taking care of it. But when it's actually going to hit Amazon.com, I don't know. I just don't know.
Yeah, that was Sam Francis's big unpublished work that was published as a giant book a few years back. And what is this new version exactly?
Well, it's a wonderful book, but you know, if Sam had lived and had seen it through the press, the editors would have encouraged him to condense it somewhat as it was. So when he died without being able to oversee the process, early on, a decision was taken to publish 2 versions, to publish it exactly as Sam wrote it, with all the repetitions, and it is a highly repetitious work, and then to sponsor an abridgment, somebody to shorten it, and I was part of that. Other people played a role. And the basic work on the abridgment or condensation has been done, but the publishing world, everything always goes much slower than you'd like it to. I hope it'll be out in the next year or so.
Okay, that's great. We should wrap up. We've been going for nearly 90 minutes. Martin, are there some final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with about this book and the broader topics that you raise here?
Well, you mentioned that in the end of the book, I wrap up the value of ethnopluralism in these 4 points. We have mentioned them before. What I was pointing out here is also that ethnopluralism is not 2 things that it is not or that it cannot be. I don't think it can be a consequently led political program. It just doesn't work if you have this as a program.
A consistent political program.
A consistent political program. It would just not work. And the second thing is, it's also not a consistent philosophy, because you will get into many contradictions about the nature of universalism and relativism. We did not get into this problem, but once you get into this, you never find your way out again. So this is why I mentioned there are four things which are valuable about it. So, and I said there's this certain outlook. It has a certain value appreciation that you value nationhood, diversity in itself as a thing, and also that it can be a helpful way of thinking outside of your box. As I said, this appreciation, the other is really different. And this also is in one way a cause for wonder, admiration, curiosity, but also of caution. Yeah? That you realize, okay, this other is different, but in a way that might harm and endanger me. There are always these two sides here. So this is one thing that I wanted to wrap up in my book, that I say this is not a political program and it cannot be a consistent philosophy because of the many contradictions you will find if you get deeper into it. And this was also a point I was making against all these, literature about the new right that says this is our program, this is our political program. I would say these are some basic ideas, some basic values, but if you go into actual concrete politics, you have to sort of postpone it. There's a phrasing I like about democracy, which is also a thing that obviously doesn't really work, as everybody knows. But the idea of democracy can be very helpful. It's a regulating idea. I hope I get this right. Regulative idea, a regulating idea. Yeah, regulative idea. And I think the same about ethnopluralism. Yeah, it keeps you it keeps your thoughts regulated. The notion that it's good to have respect of the other, it's good to notice the other is really different. It's a good thing, a universally good thing, that everybody has the right to say that I want to be different and I don't even need to reason with anyone who wants to change this. So,
The way I put it in my White Identity Politics book, where I talk about identity politics, is that within politics, there is a point where many arguments basically end when somebody says, this is who we are.
Yes.
And I don't think that we should think that's problematic. We should just recognize that ultimately a lot of political issues are just going to boil down to, we want this because this is who we are. We're comfortable with this. And we don't have to give any... We don't have to stand before some universal court of conscience and justify our right to be who we are in terms of anything above the fact that this is who we are and we wish to remain who we are.
This is what the Taliban in Afghanistan could say now. They could say, well, 99% of Afghans are comfortable with Sharia law adopted to certain tribal customs, and we don't need to be anything else. We don't need to argue about Sharia, whether it's good or bad, and that's it. So, and I also have to mention that I mentioned your book, Greg, in my book. I briefly mention it, I quote it, because there's a lot of ethno-pluralism in your book as well. I don't think the word ever appears in your book, but the spirit is there a lot. So you classify for me as an ethno-pluralist. So
yeah, just I would admit to that. Yeah, totally. I'm comfortable with that, and I'm something of a herder guy. When you get right down to it, I like the grassroots, folky, ethno-pluralist view. Roger, you wrote a review of this book. There some final thoughts you'd like to share with us all?
Not really. Except that I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it come out in English. Maybe I can translate a couple more excerpts or something.
Well, yeah, I would love that. Okay. That would be great if it's a, it's a, okay with wonder, the author.
Wonderful,
of course.
Wonderful book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you so much. I'm going to wrap up this segment here, and we will have a nice, neat 90-minute show that we will put up on the website this coming week. And I'm sure we will have many hundreds more people listening. We broke 300 live listeners today, which is quite good when we're talking about deep philosophy stuff. You know, there are a lot of live streams where people would listen for 30 seconds and hear Herder and think, I'm out of here. There's a gaming stream that I need to be at. So I think we had a good number of people for a highbrow conversation, which is what I want. And so, Martin, thank you again for coming, and Roger as well. And what I want to do now is just segue into answering some questions that have been sitting around some since last week that people had sent in. So, folks, if you would like to send your questions in through Entropy, again, you can go to entropystream.live /countercurrents without the hyphen, and you can do it there, or you can do it in DLive as well. And I'm going to say goodbye to both of our guests now, though. So, Roger, thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, and goodbye.
And Martin, the guest of honor, I really appreciate your time. And I think this was a really good conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, too. So thank you for inviting me, and goodbye.
Okay. We'll do this again. So, folks, let me just run through some of these entropy questions that I've got. Elizabeth has written in with $25. Thank you. You're always very generous. And she says, I am utterly addicted to and yet horribly blackpilled by the audacious yet brilliant Andrew Anglin. Do you know who he is, and what do you honestly think of his writing and ideas? Well, of course, everybody knows who Andrew Anglin is. He's one of the most censored men on the planet. His website is probably the most censored website on the planet. And it's amazing that the Daily Stormer is still online. I can't keep up with all the stuff that he writes. I don't follow every word that he says. I think that in the great optics war and the aftermath of the breakup of the alt-right, that he took a very sound position on a lot of things. I thought that was his finest hour, frankly. And he had a lot of very wise things to say during the whole unwinding of the Trump years. So I respect the guy. I've talked to him, I think, just on one occasion. I haven't met him in person, just we talked on Skype. And we also did a debate together, at least one. So yeah, I don't know why you're so blackpilled by him. Maybe he's taken a negative turn recently. I don't know. He's always entertaining. And so I'm glad you like him. Reed writes in with $5 and he says, there's no crystal ball, but many see this as a multi-decade struggle. It's only human to want results in our lifetime. If we're caretakers, what should be our goals? And how do we keep advocates inspired if none of us may live to see the ethnostate? I think that's a fantastic question. Yes, we have to recognize that this could be a multi-generational task. Fortunately, we've got a couple of generations to turn things around. The long-term demographic trends for white people are alarming, but the short and medium-term political trends are actually breaking in our favor. And I frankly think that the collapse of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, the sheer stupidity and disorder that was manifest in that, the people who want to give Machiavellian interpretations of what they're really up to, I think they're giving these people entirely too much credit. I think this just shows that the American system has hollowed out and it's full of incompetence and careerism and cynicism, and it's a farce. A lot of these people are going through the motions. It's just become an empty farce. And as soon as it's tested, you see the wheels fly off. You see it collapse. So it might be later than we think for the U.S. system. But still, It could be many decades before we actually turn the tide. So what sustains us? Well, what sustains us are things like we have to build in emotional rewards to this process. You cannot simply demand self-sacrifice all the time. You can't say it's nothing but blood and sweat and tears and teeth clenched, endure. People have to enjoy the process. They have to get something out of it. Well, what do you get out of it? You get friends out of it. You meet interesting people along the way and you build relationships. I've built some very good relationships with some of the finest people I've ever known in this process. They're my colleagues, they're my comrades, they're friends. That's something that you need to build. Think about founding institutions. Think about founding dynasties. If you have a family, think of them as a dynasty and bring them up that way. Bring them up to think of themselves as having a destiny and an important role, not just being another bozo with a lunch bucket and a credit card and a Netflix subscription. There's a world of difference between different market dominant minorities. There are market dominant minorities that come from the Indian subcontinent that have bought up all the cheap hotels in parts of the United States. There are market dominant minorities from the Indian subcontinent that basically own all the hardware stores in France. And then there are market dominant minorities from the Middle East that control banking and the media. And these people gravitate towards those things, not because it's just a good living, because they have a sense of destiny. And you have to impart that sense of destiny to your family, your friends, the people you influence the most. And you've got to live your life that way. It's not grandiose to actually acknowledge the fact that we have grandiose goals, namely changing the course of world history, turning around the most ominous and horrible political and demographic and cultural trend that's ever been instituted. This is a big struggle, and we have to be equal to it, and we have to have idealism. Definitely. And we have to think of ourselves as the kind of people who can accomplish this. And if you bring your kids up to think of themselves as taking part in this, I think that's important. Bring them up to gravitate towards positions of power rather than comfy positions of impotence, because that's how we change the world. We want to save all of our people, and we represent the legitimate interests of all of our people, but we have to recognize that some of our people are just hopelessly brainwashed, and they're not going to survive this great bottleneck that we're being basically driven into, this great culling that's coming. And we need to ask ourselves, how do we become the white people with the future, as opposed to the white people who don't have a future? And that's most white people today don't have a future long term. They don't even think about it. They're tweeting about their fur babies and their vasectomies and getting props from dullards on the internet for basically obliterating their futures and just being overgrown children for the rest of their lives. Those people have no future. We have to be white people with the future, and that means we have to think seriously about gravitating towards the things that give us as a community more power and more resiliency. So those are some of the things that I can say. But the ultimate thing that inspires us is going to be a vision of saving the world. We're saving the world. And when you have to get up in the morning and navigate through a lot of traffic, or when you go off to a conference, or you donate $25 or whatever, it can be a chore. And you've got to keep reminding yourself that, yeah, but we're saving the world. that's something that's inspiring. And that's the truth of the matter. That's what we're after. We're trying to save the world. So let's see if we have some more questions here. Okay, Gaddius writes in with $25. Thank you. And says, great discussion, gentlemen. I appreciate that. I am going to look back over at our friends on DLive. Bruder Klar has donated another Ninjagini. That is very generous. I really appreciate it. So I have a couple other questions here that were sent in by email. Alexandra asked me what my thoughts were on a book by a woman. I think her name is Cynthia Miller Idris, which is a kind of alarming hyphenated surname, called Hate in the Homeland. Now, I bought this book. I bought the electronic version of it and started reading it. It's out from Princeton University Press, which is an absolutely important press. It's very disturbing so far, and I think I'm going to palm this book off on one of our writers to do a very serious reading of it. As a piece of scholarship, it's incredibly superficial. It's incredibly superficial, and yet it is entirely focused on building a pseudo-academic rationale for taking away all of our civil liberties. And there's an increasing number of these academic experts who regurgitate all the same stuff from the SPLC and the ADL, who are basically making the case that the number one threat to America is not the blacks and the communists who burned down cities for the better part of a year, recently, that we live in terror of. No, it's people like you and me who notice the patterns and would like to institute some real reforms where we can fix these problems, where we can drain the swamp in which all this race hatred breeds. We're the number one problem. And so I'm very alarmed at the number of pseudo-academic books that are trying to make rationales for treating us as pariahs in our own society. So it's important, and we're going to have a serious treatment of this, a serious analysis of it at Countercurrents. Eric asked me a number of questions. I'm going to answer just one. He wants to know my favorite martial arts movies. So folks, if you have thoughts about that, chime in the comments at DLive, of course. But my favorite, okay, first of all, I'm not a big martial arts fan. But there are a couple that I really like. I really like Hero, which is a Chinese movie by Zhang Yimou. It's in that genre that I call flying Chinaman movies, where you know these people walk on water and fly through the air and things like that, because martial arts are magic, right? I just think it's an incredibly poetic film. It's beautiful to look at visually. The fights and things are remarkable and entertaining, and it's a very beautiful nationalistic film. It's the kind of nationalistic cinema that we would make in European countries if our film industry were controlled by people who are actually European and who actually wanted to make our societies healthier rather than sick. So I'm very, very jealous of the Chinese for getting really wonderful, elevating patriotic fare, and this is a really beautiful film. There was a movie made about Bruce Lee. I think it was called Hero. I thought that was a very entertaining martial arts movie. I liked Enter the Dragon, but it's kind of a camp film. And I've watched it twice. And the first time I watched it was with a friend. And when you see the black guy with the big fro get off the airplane in Hong Kong and get in a cab, my friend did the Mystery Science Theater 3000 thing and dubbed in "Take Me to Chinatown," and that just killed me. And I at that point I forget what happened for the next like 15 minutes, because that's what happens when I laugh a lot. But anyway, I do like Asian martial arts movies. But yeah, but any kind of martial arts involving guns or swords or boxing, you can have Western martial arts movies as well. I used to like movies with sword fights when I was a kid, but I honestly don't remember the names of a lot of them. I would see bits and pieces on them on television after school when I would come home. So that's my favorite martial arts movie, though, is Hero by Zhang Yimou. Also, Sutton wrote in, and he asked me to comment on anonymity. And specifically, I can't find his comment here, but basically he said, we had a piece by Jim Goad where he was talking about how he really hates trolls, and he was pouring a lot of scorn on anonymity. Now, I totally get what's going on with Jim, because I hate trolls too. I hate people who are basically insincere, and they're just gaining jollies, basically, from saying things to make people upset, or just by being an asshole online. And yeah, that is aided and abetted by anonymity, but frankly, there are people that can be giant assholes under their real name. So I just don't think anonymity is the issue here. It's somewhat enabling, but it's not entirely necessary for that kind of behavior. I just think it's bad behavior. They basically have made up these rules where if they behave badly in public and you call them out on it, you lose rather than them. I'm sorry, I don't know what moral universe they're in, but that just doesn't make sense. And they can claim them's the rules, but it makes no sense. Jim had this hilarious line where he said that, you know, they're the kind of people who badger you to turn around and look at them. And then when you do, they think you're a loser for looking at them. Well, I just don't grant their rules. I do think anonymity is enormously important, though. Hey, Jim, it's enormously important because there is such thing as truth value to statements that's independent of who you are. And you can circulate statements that are true or false, that are meant to be true or false and not just to be obnoxious, right? You can escape negative consequences for telling the truth. And I think telling the truth is a very, very important thing. So yeah, it's a great, great piece. It's very controversial. But I've defended anonymity. I've created an absolute fatwa against doxers for breaking people's anonymity. And I very much encourage that kind of behavior towards doxing, because we're a dissident political movement. And if every one of us outed ourselves tomorrow and 4 out of 10 people or whatever had their lives turned upside down, people lost their jobs, people had difficulty in their personal lives and social circles, if we lose financial and political and social capital, that makes the movement weaker. If we take off the mask all of a sudden and make ourselves targets for the enemy, that makes us weaker rather than stronger. So I've always had this emphasis on respecting people's decisions to be anonymous and not pouring scorn on them or doxing them. So anyway, that's basically my thoughts on that. So I'm going to check one more time at Entropy and see if there are any more people who are chipping in with questions and comments and donations. And there aren't. We are done, folks. We've wrapped it up. So thank you very much. I want to thank our guests earlier, Martin Lichtmetz and also Roger Devlin. I want to thank all of you listeners out there, the donors amongst you. You're very generous. And of course, the moderators who've been keeping it all very civil and nice. So thank you very much. And we will definitely be back again next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. Again, we're starting an hour later on Sunday. Also, Countercurrents is now sponsoring Nick Gielby, who's hosting the Writer's Block. And he's doing that on Saturdays at the old time, that namely noon Pacific, 3 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock UK time, and 9 o'clock Central European time. He's in Central Europe. So anyway, tune in on Friday, or on Saturday, for another episode of the Writer's Block. And one of the purposes of the Writer's Block is to highlight more of our great writers at Countercurrents. People were saying, have more of your authors on the show, Greg. And so I'm acceding to that. I just had Roger Devlin on. Next week on Sunday, I'm going to have both Mark Gullick and Stephen Foster on. That'll be Sunday, the 12th of September. And on September 11th, Catherine S. will be on with Nick Gilvey, who's a valued writer, and a sometime contributor, and a guy who's in the chat right now, the Z-Man, is going to be joining him. At least that's the plan. So that's going to be a great show as well. So folks, we're going to be doing two live streams a week because you deserve it. And we'll be back soon with more episodes of Countercurrents Radio.